I mean, I had some funny trips. There was this one trip I can remember that was like ridiculous, where I like used my dad's cross country skis and had like my snowboard on my back to do this like big approach into this zone. And I like cross country skied in, and like, it was just like insane.
Dark Starts Backcountry Splitboarding Podcast is supported by Phantom Snow Industries. Join the revolution and go higher, lighter, further, and faster. Visit their website at phantomsnow.com or visit ours at darkstarts.ca for more info. This episode is supported by our friends at Cardiff Snowcraft, leading the way with premium, durable, and innovative splitboards. If you're exploring the mountains in search of deep, untracked snow, you're one of us. We invite you to experience Cardiff. Find them at cardiffsnow.com and seek out your stand in high places moment with Cardiff Snowcraft. Hello, folks, and welcome to episode 94 of Dark Starts, your backcountry splitboarding podcast. Today, we're talking with Cardiff team rider Stratton Madison out of Bend, Oregon. From bootpacking to eventually getting his first splitboard, Stratton's missions now include traveling to the trailhead on his bike. Join Maxwell and I as we talk with Stratton about how he got started in splitboarding and how two wheels and two planks are what now propel him to his greatest heights. All right, we're dropping in with Stratton Madison. Stratton, how you doing today, bud?
Doing great. Just enjoying watching the snowflakes falling out here.
That's beautiful, man. I love the fact that we're talking about what we're talking about and you're watching the snow falling right now.
Fucking yeah.
Stellar.
I'm just thinking about getting back up there as soon as possible.
Sorry, did you want to redo this another time?
This will work.
All right, cool.
Yeah, so you're in Bend right now, huh?
Yep, here in Bend, Oregon on the edge of the Cascade Volcanoes.
Nice. How's the season been so far over there?
It's been pretty good. We typically have a usually pretty abundant early season here. I'd say it's like, it's pretty average. Been getting some good storms, and Alpine's kind of filling in, still a little thin down low, but yeah, been getting a lot of nice days. It's been pretty cold, so there's been some good cold powder, and yeah, it's off to a great start.
Nice. Love to hear it, man. It's like, it's great to see everyone across the West getting snow.
Yeah.
So, you know, when one area is getting the abundance of it, everyone else kind of frosts.
Yeah. And
it's good to see that Tahoe and you and up north and us. And yeah, it's great to see. It keeps the stoke alive for everyone. And
yeah,
the party wave video that you posted the other day was so fun to watch.
Yeah, that was great. That was just like a consolation prize, because like the mountains here got hit with some insane wind. We were up there the day before that, and it was like, you know, gusting like 50, and you just could barely hang around because it was just so cold. But, you know, able to find some nice snow in the right spots, and it's always a good time.
I'm just kind of snickering a little bit at what you just said, because, dude, that's my backyard, man. it's cold, all of that.
Yeah. It's super cold up where you are.
Yeah, well, usually when we're riding, if it's not blowing really hard and it's not really cold, that's a beauty day, because generally it's doing just that. By the time you crest a ridge and you're above the trees, you're in for exactly that where we live right here, which kind of sucks sometimes. So,
right. Yeah, I think I wouldn't even really be quite used to what you're used to up there, because I'm sure relatively it's a lot warmer down here.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But you know,
it's temperate.
Yeah, absolutely. And listening to what you guys are saying about the snow, man, this year feels like that. You ever see one of those videos of a freight train coming along and it's got one of those big plows on it for plowing the snow?
Oh, yeah.
The snow's all, yeah.
Yeah,
that's what this winter feels like right now. Like the snow just hit us in the face like one of those
trains.
Winter's
the train.
Yeah. exactly. It's been a crazy change of seasons where I live up here, because usually we don't get a fall where I live. It's we usually go like, we get like maybe a week's worth of fall and then bam, we're into the winter, whereas this year we got like the entire month of October.
Yeah.
Which was stellar. Loved it, you know? And then bam, here's the snow. Bam, just dropped it on us. Fucking great. Love it.
Totally.
Yeah, we're loving it down here, that's for sure. It's been
awesome.
It's been definitely that freight train. It was like the leaves were like so vibrant and you know, mm-hmm. and I'm taking a ride on my motorcycle up the canyon and just knowing that the impending freight train's coming at us and it's just like boom, 32 yeah. inches. It's
totally.
Like, okay. And it's still fall. It's like we've just been like blown away down here. But like in the Cascades, it's like that's another place that I love and have spent a lot of time in. And it's really mm-hmm. near and dear to me, like where kind of I grew roots in the Pacific Northwest and traveling from Baker all the way down to Shasta and splitboarding a lot of those areas. And the Bend area with the Sisters and Jefferson and Bachelor, it's like there's such a magical zone down there. And it's such a rad, like with Smith Rock, and it's just like so beautiful down there.
No, it's incredible. It's like a dense, like it has some of the densest volcanoes, you know. There's just like they're all kind of packed in together right here. And so it's nice to not just have like a singular big peak as far as the Cascades go. You know, there's quite a few different zones you can go out to. And it's nice being in the desert here as well. I'm sure you relate being in Salt Lake. Like I could really just never live on the west side of these mountains. It would just be too wet and dreary for me. You know, I really appreciate having that sun.
Yeah, absolutely. It's nice to have the differences between west and east in that area. And like, and the coast is so close as well.
Yeah.
It's just Oregon's such a beautiful state. It's, it's really familiar to me with Maine and the way it's the topography and the climate is down there. Mm. And so did you grow up in Bend and did you learn to snowboard around the Bend area and learn to splitboard in the Bend area?
I was born in Eugene over on the west side of the mountains here. Lived there till I was like 5. Then my family moved to Vermont, which is where my mom's family is from. And, you know, like generations back have been there for a couple hundred years even. And so my mom wanted to go back there to be closer to my grandparents. And I pretty much was raised there, learned to snowboard there as well. And then me and my dad actually moved back out here like 8 years ago when I was a junior in high school. So that's kind of the path I've taken. And when I was back in Vermont, I always missed the West Coast in Oregon. Cause that was like, you know, I was raised there until I was like 5 or 6. And then we would spend every summer out West. And it was just, you know, in my heart, that's like where I was pulled to be back out here. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Like full circle, right? It's just like you had that draw of being out West again.
Yeah.
Do you think because of your birth, like, you know, because that's how I feel. Like I was born in Maine and it's like,
really?
It's always like that draw to get back home and it feels like home. So it's like, maybe was that the same kind of thing for you? And
oh, it definitely was. Yeah. I was always thinking about it and dreaming about it. And I definitely feel like a Vermonter too, because I spent like a lot of my younger years there and like formative years as a youth there, but still was always called back out West and especially to the Pacific Northwest. Like we were just talking, like, I just love the diversity of the environments here in the Pacific Northwest and your ability to get to the coast, to get to the rainforest, be in the desert, be in, you know, high glaciated peaks in such a dense, compact area. It's just like kind of has it all. And then also on top of that, I just love like the culture and communities of the Pacific Northwest. Just kind of like, I don't know, easygoing, like just kind of, you know, hippie loving people out here. It's just like good vibes. I don't know. I love it.
Darren can relate to that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That westward pull.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, what's interesting is, I mean, I'm from the East as well, from Ontario, Canada. Mm-hmm. Lived in the New York, New Jersey area for a long time. So very close to that New England feel and zone. In fact, where my wife and I lived before we moved out here was upstate New York.
Nice.
In a little mountain village, specifically because that's what called to me and what I wanted. And then we decided to move out here. This is where I wanted to be, man. Making this move was an easy decision for me, you know, because the mountains were where I wanted to be and being out west.
Yeah.
But I don't feel that pull to go back to Ontario, man. Yeah. I do not fucking hate Ontario, to be honest with you. And, you know, all love to people that I know in Ontario and what's going on out there. But I just, yeah. I do not miss the icy slopes of the hills in Ontario. That's for sure, man.
Makes you a better snowboarder, though, for sure.
I agree 100%, man. It's funny because, you know, I coach snowboarding here locally, Stratton, and and the kids in our club, the name of our hill is called Nighthawk, and they often refer to it as Ice Hawk.
Yeah,
I'm like, you guys have no clue, man.
Right?
You have no. This is not icy. This is not icy. I'll show you icy, man. Like,
take them on a field trip.
Yeah.
Like, try and get your edge. Try and get your edge in on that, man. Like, there's not happening, you know. But
that's what they would call a white face up there in upstate New York. They call it ice face.
Oh yeah,
yeah, that was the nickname. But you know, they always say like ice coast. It's so icy, and like, you know, Vermont's not that bad actually. Like, and honestly, like, it'll get pretty icy out here in the Cascades too. Like, almost icier at points. Like, because you'll just get these like huge wet storms, and then all of a sudden the mountains are just coated in like just a sheet of ice, you know. Versus back there, I felt like it was always just like there was just like these patches of like blue ice and stuff over like weird little like waterfall features and stuff like that. But
yeah,
you know, yeah, definitely just like hardened you as a rider growing up in the East Coast. I feel like, you know, totally, to the cold as well. It's freezing up there in Vermont, and I mean, it's usually just thin more so than anything, you know,
that's why you got to have those flannels like you're wearing right now, bud.
Exactly.
You got that wicked flannel on right now. Yeah, people can't see that, but
yeah, that's that Vermont piece. Yeah.
You can take the kid out of Vermont, but you can't take the Vermont out of the kid.
Exactly. Yeah.
I love it.
So Stratton, what got you into splitboarding? Like, how did that happen? Like, you said you've been splitboarding now for 7 years. Like, what was the pull and the drive for that?
Well, growing up skiing in Vermont, I felt like I grew up in this skiing in this ski area called Bolton Valley, which is kind of like mid-sized, like mom and pop resort. You know, there's like, you got your Stowe, you got your Killington, which are like the huge resorts with the fancy lodges and all that. Like, I never really went to those because I couldn't really afford to go to those spots. And Bolton Valley was just like 10 minutes away from my house. So that was nice. I could go skiing up there like 5 days a week as just, you know, in elementary school and middle school. And they had a lot of just like side country and glades there. So I was always like sneaking into the woods, and like, we would go do little boot packs like as kids and be like up to our necks in powder, just like trudging through this snow, like trying to go find some like little like sneaker glade thing. So I think I was always just kind of like interested and pulled to be riding and just like, you know, natural settings and kind of like off the beaten path looking for powder. So then once I moved out here, I was riding at Mount Bachelor a lot, and I was kind of like very much into the park scene at that time, doing a lot of that kind of riding and riding rails and whatnot. But I still love just like free riding the mountain, going looking for fresh tracks and putting together fun lines and stuff. And I then just met some friends that first season out here that were into splitboarding. And it's funny, like, I don't even really remember when I first heard about it exactly, but like, coming from Vermont, I didn't know what splitboarding was. Like, especially like 7-8 years ago, it wasn't really a popular thing, especially out there. Maybe I just wasn't quite in the know, but like, I didn't even really know it existed or was a thing. And then I think I just moved out here, had some friends that were doing it, and it seemed like the, you know, the way to go, get up in the mountains and get off the beaten path. So first season out here, it was the 2014-2015 season, and it was the driest season on record for the Oregon Cascades. And that meant there was just like a ton of hard packed snow, a lot of corn snow, and warm temps and whatnot. And I just started head out into the backcountry with some of my buddies that had split boards, but I didn't have one that first season. And I just ended up like bootpacking a lot of this stuff with snowshoes or like even without snowshoes, because it was just like there's dry trails up to the snow line. And then the snowpack was just hard pack, and you could just start bootpacking up some lines like straight out of the gates. So that first season was kind of my first introduction into the backcountry, because I was able to get like a decent amount of days and get on some fun lines without a split board that year.
I love that, that didn't keep you away from it. Hey, like you, like everybody else was skinning and you're fucking, like we've had it described to us in the past as misery slippers when you're on the snowshoes.
Oh,
hey,
yeah.
Everybody else is gliding up and, but you kept going.
It's
hey,
a slog. Like
it didn't. Yeah. Oh yeah.
No. Yeah. I mean, I think I was just stoked to check it out and do what I could with what I had. And, yeah, I mean, there was some ridiculous stuff, and I always just look back at that, and I'm really grateful for my partners that were willing to take me out at that time, because I look at myself and think, like, I was a total kook. Like, you know, I just didn't have the right equipment. Like, I was just out there bootpacking. Like, if someone asked me to take them out most days, like, without a split board, you know, 6 miles into, like, the wilderness or something, I would, like, I'd be pretty hesitant, you know, and be like, oh, no, like, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to take that person out. And, like, so I'm always just very grateful for those friends that like were willing to take me out and show me what was going on. And I mean, I had some funny trips. There was this one trip I can remember that was like ridiculous, where I like used my dad's cross country skis and had like my snowboard on my back to do this like big approach into this zone. And I literally like cross country skied in, and like, it was just like insane.
Okay. So the first thing that comes to mind when you're saying that, as soon as you said I had my dad's cross country skis, the first thing I thought of was riding down with those skis strapped to your pack. I mean, is that what you had to do?
No, like that's it was like third. It was like to approach in, because it was kind of like a rolling approach. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like I was going up the slope and then going to drop back down. It was like a rolling approach for like 5 or 6 miles to the zone that we were going to then ride out of. So I used those to get in. And then once I got in, I was just like bootpacking everything.
So you just stashed them at the bottom. I get it.
Yeah, no, but there's still somewhere this hilarious video where like I'm cross country skiing and my split board's on my back. And it was just,
we need that video.
Yeah. I should try to dig that up. It's somewhere on my phone, I think. You should try to dig that up. But, that was a great, like, that was honestly like the perfect season to be able to do it and get out there without without a split board. And it was funny too, because like everyone was complaining about the snow that year because it was so dry, the conditions were poor. But coming from the East Coast, I was like, are you kidding me? Like, this is like, we got 4 or 5 feet at the base here. Like, this is more snow than, you know, at the peak of our season back in Vermont. And like, so to me, I was just jazzed and, you know, excited about it all. And it was the season after that, 2015, 2016, I want to say. That's the first year I got a split board. So like after that season, I knew I needed a split board, and I just like saved up to get one and got a Jones hovercraft, and then was hooked.
Dude, you didn't go light. I love that. You didn't go light, man. You dove right into, like, you knew what you wanted, eh? After.
Yeah. I mean, I think that
after doing that,
that whole season, I knew I needed the split board, but I just was like, I want to say I was like 17, 18 that year. So I was like, I couldn't really afford to buy like a split board setup, you know? But yeah, then that next year just went fully in, and I was still riding the resort a good amount, but like, I think even after that first season, I was like 50% split boarding. And then it kind of just increased slowly from there to the point where like, I really practically hardly ever go to the resort anymore. And that's more out of just like, I'm just always like, would rather go split boarding most of the time.
Perfect. Perfect. That's exactly why you're on here.
Yeah.
So I can see why your friends, you know, like you said, you know, you'd be hesitant to have somebody boot packing in 6 miles to go to an approach to hit something. I can see why your friends were still stoked to have you along, man. I mean, your energy and your love for it is right there. It's like, dude, how could we not have Stratton along on this tour, man? Like, even if we got to carry him, he's coming in on this tour, man. Exactly. I can see how that's happening.
Yeah.
So I love it. Obviously, you felt the love. I could see how you could bring the energy to the group and get that going. And that's fucking awesome, man. I love that about you. Obviously, you decided you needed to get the equipment. You bought yourself a hovercraft. Was it just that? Like, obviously, you had to get the bindings too. Mm-hmm. And what about all that heavy gear and all that training that you needed to go on top of that as well?
Yeah, no, that was like, I knew I needed to take an avalanche course. So I went and did first season with a split board. Went and did that like December and January. And, I was very into it and focused. And like, I was out digging pits like all the time after I got my first Avi course in, and, was just like, yeah, really just wanted to learn and like get the skills and, put them in use. And so, yeah, I just started, going headfirst in on it.
How'd you feel after that first Avi course, man? Like when you walked out of that first class, like, did that change your mindset at all about the backcountry, like and going out into the backcountry? Because previous to that, what was your knowledge level? I mean, were you in that ignorant bliss level where you were just like enjoying the backcountry, loving it? All your partners had that all dialed in and tuned in and you just went and rode. Did it change anything internally for you after you took that first course?
I don't think I ever had like an ignorance as bliss. And I also don't think I had like a shock factor either. Like some people do when they take their first Avi course where they're just like, I just don't even want to be in these mountains. Like these avalanches are going to kill me. You know, the mountains are just like out to get me. I don't think I quite ever had that either, but I always had a huge respect for them and knew the danger. And I knew that they needed respect and observation and time and, and I was lucky to have partners that were very tuned in already. Like, one of my first partners was like very skilled and was always wanting to give the snow the benefit of the doubt. And yeah, like they were always on it. They were always digging, looking at the snow, always. I think just like after my first course, I just like had more skills to put into practice and start like actually being able to do it on my own and do it with other partners. And I just had like a healthy level of respect for the danger. And yeah, there was definitely some time of just like learning how to dig pits and read the weather and the snow and being able to make a trip plan based on that and assess conditions on my own. And there was definitely like a continued path of just like putting my experiences together to be able to make decisions out there. And
I'm glad you touched on that, Stratton, because that's really important when you're first starting out, right? When you get that intro courses and you start really seeing the big picture mm-hmm. of the mountains, and it does change your perspective mm-hmm. a little bit because you're just becoming more knowledgeable and finding that group that is similar on the same page, right? So now you can enter the conversation and you can ask the right questions and you can all make good decisions together as a group for your objectives. Yeah. And it's really important because people getting into the backcountry, it's kind of daunting, yeah. right? So you have to get all this equipment, then you got to get the education, and you got to find the right people. So it's great that you touched on that you had those people that were willing to, one, yeah. take you and be patient into the backcountry and also allow you to add to the conversation and become part of the group. And I think that's really important these Definitely. Days that people have that. And that's not always the case, right? You always have to try and find the right partners that are on the same level or a little bit right. more advanced. They can kind of show you the way. And it's great that you had that as your foundation. So do you, now that you're like where you mm-hmm. are now, right? Cause from that point to now, you've accelerated your split boarding. You're quite a leading force in the bike to board movement. Mm-hmm. And, so do you find yourself helping other people along and guiding them in their quest to become a split boarder or enter the mountains?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like just like picking up new partners and folks that are like interested in getting out there. And then going out and, just making decisions together, and folks that aren't as skilled or maybe knowledgeable, we'll just like learn and observe the mountains together and kind of show them what I know. And then I'm always trying, if someone's at a lower skill level than I, like I'm always trying to involve them. Like even when I go out with people that are maybe like the same level riders or gung-ho, but they don't have the same experience level in the backcountry, I'm always trying to I'm always trying to involve them and get everyone in the party involved in the decision making, like to whatever level they can be. You know, I never like to be, even if, you know, you're the most skilled person in the group, I never like to be the one that's like guiding or making the call, because to me, if something were to go wrong, I don't want to be like, I made all the calls. I want to try to involve everyone to the level that we can, you know?
Yeah. You're giving everyone a voice, right? And that's a good place to be.
Yeah. And sometimes I've been out with some people that like, maybe they're not actually like fully tapping into their voice or like speaking up fully. And they're kind of just setting back, doing a little bit of like, you know, the sheep mindset, just like, I'm going to follow the herd here. But I want to get everyone involved as much as we can and like bounce ideas back off each other. And even whatever their intuition is, like, just like ask them what they're feeling and get that all involved, you know, so that we can make a solid group consensus.
I love that. You know, we've had discussions with people in the past talking about their training and why they got into it. For me, obviously, I wanted to be in the backcountry, and similar to your, you know, your mind state when you went into it, I had the same healthy respect for what was out there. I knew what the dangers were. I just didn't understand them fully. But I'm not going to lie, I came out of my first AST1 course not scared, but just more eye opened, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And aware. And I was like, holy fuck, like it's more dangerous than I thought it was, you know? And I honestly had a little bit of that ignorant bliss going in originally. Some of the people that we've talked to in the past had made the comments to us regarding their training and how it was important to them to be able to give or lend their voice to what the decisions were in the backcountry, right? Like, I agree with you. It's not good for one person to think that they're in control of it all. It's also not good for anybody who has a thought in their head to not want to express that thought, right? Like, one of the things, and this is a bit of a joke on this podcast, but I taught scuba diving 15 years.
Okay.
And one of the things that I tried and got into was cave diving. Mm. And cave diving, I found out, just wasn't my favorite thing to ever do. It wasn't my happy place. I didn't feel the most comfortable in a cave. But one rule we always had in cave diving was that anybody at any time can turn the dive. If any one person is not comfortable, and for whatever reason, and there's no judgment held, they turn the dive. And when they say, I want out, we all go out together as a group, because it's the safest thing to do and the best thing to do, right? So I agree. It is important for everybody to have a voice and be part of the decision, for sure.
Yeah, I agree. The most conservative voice in the group should be respected. And like, that's, you know, if someone's feeling, they're not feeling it, like the whole group should follow that intuition, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. So in your experience, and where you are today, what is your, let's just dive into that a little bit more. Like, what is your level of knowledge today, with regards to, avalanche awareness? Like, have you taken it up from your basic level one? Have you gone above that?
Just level two. And then a lot of just like in the field experience, really, is kind of where I'm at. Like, I haven't felt the draw to go above that at this point, mainly just
like to get,
or like get level three or become certified on another level. Although I do want to continue education. I just have a lot of time going out in the field and, making decisions for me and my party and with other partners and, assessing snow together. And I feel like that's where, you know, just the past few years, I've been like gaining a lot of experience just doing that, just being out and using it. Yeah.
Sweet. I love that. How, so you got a pretty core group of dudes that you're out with all the time, or people that you like to ride with?
No, I have like a few really solid partners around here, and, you know, we'll kind of chase each other around too a bit. But yeah, I've got like few people that I go out with primarily and just like mesh really well with, and are usually, you know, interriding the same terrain and moving at the same pace, and also then having a really good fun time together. I feel like that's a like important thing. I think you can have like people that maybe you would like, they're good riders or they're skilled mountain folks, but if you're not having fun together and like just like having a great time, it's not the same. I feel like I really enjoy having people that I'm just joking around with and then also can communicate well with and mesh well with.
You know, have all your experiences in the backcountry been positive ones? Like, have you had any scary close calls with anything, with any conditions, with avalanches, for example?
I've definitely had a few. You know, and also sometimes I feel like it's sometimes easy to forget about certain situations. Sometimes I'll like think back and I'll forget something that was a close call sometimes. And it's important to remember all of those experiences and like hold them with you each day so that you can, you know, keep that gained experience and knowledge with you to help you make decisions safer in the future. I mean, one close call I can think of that could have been pretty bad was, this was like a couple years ago in the Sierra, south of Mammoth there. The storm was clearing and it was still snowing that day. It was forecasted to be sunny, but it just kind of kept dumping. And I think we just had this way too ambitious plan for the day. Like we were like, oh, we're going to go ski this big peak and then we're going to link up with this other big peak and we're going to try to ski this like pretty big couloir. And it was just like way too gung-ho for the day and for the conditions. And we went to climb up this couloir because it was that you could climb in from above, but it was still snowing. And we wanted to be able to assess the conditions on the way. So we decided to go up the thing. And we were just scanning up the apron. We get to the bottom of the couloir where it starts to get walled in. And we're going to transition to throwing on like crampons and whatnot to boot up. And like I said, it's still like snowing hard at this point. And we'd just gotten ready and we're like about to boot pack out when like a whole, you know, shoot wide slough just comes like raging down this thing. And if we were skinny, like if we were there 30 seconds before, or like one of us had stepped out 30 seconds later, like we would have for sure been at least swept. Maybe not buried or anything, but like would have all been swept off our feet. And it was one of those moments where the mountains really showed us a clear sign, and we got very lucky that the timing was as it was, because we didn't do anything right to be in the right spot. Like we just got lucky, you know, we just weren't there when it came down. That was a close call. And it was one of those moments where, you know, we were lucky enough that the mountain blessed us with the sign and we weren't in the path of danger at the time. And I feel like that happens, can happen a lot in the mountains where just it's all timing and luck, a big part of it, you know. And when you get those signs, you really got to listen to them. And that was a huge sign that like our whole plan for that day was just like too aggressive and too ambitious. And, you know, the mountains were kind enough to show us that sign when none of us were in the way. And I just, you know, every time I go out, I'm always just looking, observing, keeping respect to the mountains and trying to pay attention to all the signs that are being shown to us. And I think it's really important to listen to them and not let ego or desire overtake you and, you know, get drawn in by really nice conditions or a pretty looking slope, and just look at all the information very critically and plainly as it is.
Yeah. Can I say, like, I'm kind of curious, as a result of that event, what do you think you learned from it? Like, was there something, like, did you learn why that did that?
I think I learned, sometimes it's hard to do, but you got to give snow time to settle, for one. And I think two, we had like a plan based on the weather that we created a day before, but we didn't really adjust it when the conditions changed that day. Like we, you know, it was supposed to be sunny, like I was saying, but the storm extended and we just went along with the same plan that was just way too ambitious and aggressive for the day. And we didn't, you know, as we were skinning up there, we didn't talk about let's do something different. We just kept going on with this plan that we had created. And I think that's maybe a little bit of that like attachment to the desire and to a certain idea, and not really responding to what the current situation is.
So the storm didn't get the memo.
The storm didn't get the memo about our plan. No, no, it didn't.
I mean, it was fucking like, storm.
Yeah, come on. Yeah. And I think, too, I mean, a huge lesson was just like, and I've been in situations like that where I have been like climbing up like a QR feature or something in like kind of mixed, slightly clearing, but stormy conditions. Because sometimes on a day like that, it could be like a decent feature to be in because you have like some visibility and like you have some perspective and depth in there. But you're also just like totally exposed to whatever hang fire is above you. And on a line like that, where it's like, you know, it's 2,500 feet and it's cloudy, you can't even see the top of this thing. You really are just kind of like rolling the dice a little bit. As far as what's going to, you know, what's going to come down. And I think with that, where the snow rate was still just like really intense, it was, and it was kind of like obvious hindsight 2020 that like stuff could be moving down it. And like, as we were skidding up that apron, there was like, we could see some fresh, like sloughing and debris. And like, after that happened, we were, it was pretty obvious. Like, all right, this thing's probably been doing this like every 30 minutes or, you know, like,
well, it's because it's like you said, that storm was just constantly snow. So it was just like fresh was just loading, 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 yeah. Drop, load, 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 drop.
Exactly.
Like every 30 minute cycle type of thing. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm taking from it. Listening to it in my my lack of experience and education. Right. Well, not lack of, but limited, certainly, mm-hmm. You know, but seems to make sense to me.
Yeah.
Given it that time to settle, always good. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it's tough, especially like come spring out here too. We'll get these really nice spring storms, but you kind of like to get the snow before it gets too hot. And then you're really dealing with like that rapid warming and increase in temperatures and higher likelihood of stuff moving. Sometimes you're gambling between, you know, trying to catch that snow when it's still cold and trying to make a move on it when you can, but you're also just risking like not giving it any time to settle. And especially out here in the Cascades, like a lot of times we're just dealing with an avalanche problem that's the new snow, because it's often falling on like a really dense bed surface that's all locked up. But you know, so our main factor is like, if you can give the snow at 24 hours or more, you're going to have a lot higher likelihood of the snow being bonded together well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's like the maritime climates, man. They're like different, right? And you're speaking the truth. It's like, you got to pay attention to those red flags. We always talk about like those acronyms that we always use, facets, alt truth, like, mm-hmm. And the red flags is like, just mm-hmm. Your knowledge base to make good decisions. And sometimes you got to override that desire, but like of that objective and say, hey, today's not the day, and listen to the mountain mm-hmm. speak, and you got to listen to them. And if you don't, you know, mm-hmm. some things can happen that, you know, you don't want to happen to you, yeah. Or your group or your friends around you. And yeah, good decision making is crucial in the mountains for sure, dude.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. This just reminds me, actually, probably one of the other like closer calls that I can think of, because luckily to this day, I haven't had too many close calls. Like, really, this other story I'm about to tell is the only avalanche I've ever triggered that was unintentional. Like, I've made ski cuts where I was like, this could pop, but I confidently like made the ski cut knowing that that could happen and was trying to like flush out the feature or whatnot. But last year we were, heading into one of the local volcanoes here, and, we had this whole pattern last year where it was just like, there was a lot of high pressure and sun. I think it was the same thing for you, Maxwell, in Utah. But there was a lot of these small little storms that would come in with just like 4 inches or something. And this was one of those scenarios where there was a super, stubborn, firm ice crust that had was created by some rain, like a rain event or something that we had, So we had this really like sheeny, like glazed iced firm bed surface. And then we just got this teeny storm. It was only like 4, maybe 6 inches at most. And we were cruising up, and I think we almost just like completely let our guard down because there was so little fresh snow. I mean, we were skinning in on like 2 inches of new snow. And we went to go boot up this, another kind of shoot couloir feature. And, I think our guard and our avalanche awareness was just like totally down. We kind of were just like, I don't know. We just had shut it off. And I think part of it was there wasn't a ton of new snow. And so we weren't really super concerned about it, but we just like didn't even really like look into the snow at all. Like we were skinning up on firm snow. So we weren't really even in fresh snow until we were at the base of this thing. And then we were starting to boot up it. And it would have taken me to see that this snow had the ability to slide was to do like a couple hand shears on the way up. But I think just because, like I was saying, I was in like 4 inches of new snow. I just was like, brain was off. Like our whole group wasn't really thinking about it much. And we were climbing up this thing, and I was like 300 feet from the top of this line. And it was like a good line, I guess, to start with. It wasn't the most exposed or, it had a clean run out. It was just kind of like a big wide couloir that was just went into a really nice open apron. There was no rocks. There was nothing to really hit if it did slide. So in that way, in that sense, it was like, wasn't the worst feature to go investigate things on, but we got up it too high without even looking into the snow. And, you know, like I said, it's 300 feet from the top of this thing. And a couple minutes before triggering the slide, I was literally like front pointing on crampons. Like there wasn't even any fresh snow. So I was like more thinking like, this is icy. Like I wasn't even really like looking into the snow. And then I moved beyond that, that front pointing section. And I was booting in like 2 to 4 inches of new snow. But then I kind of crossed over into this loaded pocket at the top where it was a little bit deeper, and I took this one step, and then I just like heard the snapping sound like more than I've ever heard. Like I said, I really have rarely ever triggered a slide unintentionally. Like that was the worst slide I've triggered unintentionally. And I heard that like whole snapping sound. It was pretty crazy. And I just like ran to the right, to the edge of this feature. And luckily I was able to like, it kind of moved slow at first, and I was able to run right to the side. But you know, I had three partners below me, and I could see my one friend there, and I knew it was just going to sweep him right off his feet. And I, you know, turned around and I yelled avalanche. And I like the last thing I saw was like him standing right there in this snow, all the snow starting to move and go, you know, took him right off his feet. And, obviously it was just a terrible feeling, terrible thing to see. And, luckily everyone was okay. And everyone just like three people took this ride below me, and, they were all okay. They just took like a 500 foot ride. That was really scary, but like nobody got hurt. And, you know, probably the worst that could have happened was like some sort of like leg injury or something like that. Like I said, it was a really clean run out, and it wasn't that big of a line. It was maybe like 1,000 vertical feet total. It was just one of those moments where we got complacent, and we weren't, you know, fully looking into the snow. We weren't really respecting it because it wasn't that much new snow. But, you know, hindsight, it was a super slick bed surface, and there was a lot of wind prior to this event. And it was just a really good reminder to always, always just give the mountains like 100% attention and respect, and to never let your guard down, no matter what, you know, the conditions are. And that was like kind of a surprising event, but it was like, yeah, like I said, the worst avalanche situation I've really ever been in.
And it's important, like, you know, to know your risk tolerance. And it's like, even in early season, the smallest things can create injuries like trauma, right? Mm-hmm. And your partner's below you. And it's good to reflect on that and share that story. So thank you. It's mm-hmm. important as we go into the season that we put on our thinking caps as far as, you know, our risk assessment, terrain management,
mm-hmm.
doing your drills again, doing your companion rescue, getting mm-hmm. sharpening that axe, right? Mm-hmm. Not only your mindset, but just your skill set. And so now, like, you've gotten into splitboarding, you've put some miles under your feet, you've done some amazing adventures, you have a great kind of reference of experience, right? And now you're adding one more factor to your adventures, and it's utilizing two wheels, right? So
yeah,
you want to, what's up with that? What's with the whole bike to board thing, man? It's so amazing. Like, I've been watching you for years, and it's like, I love it. Like, it's something that I don't necessarily gonna do.
Yeah.
You know, I'd rather brat myself, but I love the whole bike thing. And so can you talk about, like, the bike to board and, like, how you feel about that and what drives you and what motivates you with that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think how I got into it was, I mean, I was never, when I got into backcountry, I was never really attracted to snowmobiling, helicopters, and all of that. I mean, I think I just, like, the way I was raised and then the influences of media and things I've read and whatnot, like, I just have a environmental ethos around respecting the earth and then respecting, I mean, honestly, just, like, trying to be a part of this change so that we can have a livable future and a livable planet for future generations. And I mean, even for my generation, like, we're going to be dealing with the extreme consequences of climate change. We're already dealing with it. And, like, by the time, you know, I'm, like, 70 years old, like, things could be pretty serious. And I think just being aware to that, I've always just kind of reflected and analyzed, like, well, what's my role in this and how am I connected to all of this? And so, yeah, like, even when I first got into backcountry, like, I wasn't attracted to those means to access the mountains because it felt like a waste to me, like a waste of resources, and it's contributing to the problem. And, you know, this problem obviously goes way beyond snow and mountains and snowboarding. But, like, if you want to look at it from just that small of a perspective, it's like, I don't want to be contributing to the demise of this thing I love so much, which is, like, healthy snowpacks and, like, cold winters and whatnot. So when I saw people sledding, or when I even, you know, did a little bit of that myself when I first got into splitboarding to go access places, it just didn't feel congruent with what I knew and what I felt. And I know it's like burning fossil fuels contributes to climate change. Therefore, I'd like to limit how much I'm doing that to not be a part of the problem, because that's just, like, doesn't feel good to me, you know? And I feel like the change needs to happen, needs to start somewhere. And for me, it's like, it's not going to happen if I continue to be a part of this paradigm and this, you know, using fossil fuels to access the mountains. So, I mean, I remember when I first got into splitboarding, even that being a conflict of, like, people always wanting to use sleds to access the mountains, beyond just, like, the fossil fuels too. I don't really, resonate with just, like, the speed and the noise and the, like, that. To me, it feels a little exploitive a little bit. It's just kind of like, get in, get out, get my thrills and get out. Like, I need to get back to town. Whereas, like, I'd rather take the slow route. Just, like, from my perspective, honor the mountains by giving them a bit of myself and a bit of my energy to get into them. And so, yeah, especially around here where we have, like, there's not the best access, there's not the best roads in place to get close to these mountains. Like, you often have to approach here in the Cascade Volcanoes, especially in my region. You know, people are like, you can't access these mountains without a snowmobile. Like, that's what a lot of people mm-hmm. think. Yeah. And it's actually funny, though, because around here, a lot of people get stuck going to these few locations based on where they can go with their snowmobile. And honestly, a lot of the best terrain is somewhere you can't get with a snowmobile. And so honestly, leaving that whole idea behind, I feel like has allowed me to get into really nice terrain with no, where there's nobody there. But that was always just a, a contrast of people always wanting to use that. I was just like, okay, I want to turn that down. And that was kind of the first step I took, was like, there was a point when I would, you know, go bump out. I never owned a sled or anything, but I'd go bump out with people and do that. And it just like, it didn't inspire me. And if,
yeah, it sounds like it doesn't mesh with just who you are as a person and and what you want to experience in the mountains. And I totally respect that, man. It's like, it's the one thing I like about splitboarding and hiking up and spending so much time hiking is you get to slow things down and really take the mountains in.
Exactly.
Right? And listen to the mountains and feel the mountains and feel the wind and feel the weather. And it's like, I get it. It's like, you know, sometimes I like to brap, but like it's, I can appreciate and respect like that slow approach. And especially like I've watched you pedaling up, you know, these mountain passes and these roads and how you film it. And it's like, it transports me into that experience where it's, you know, you get transported into other experiences too, but it's just such an amazing, niche that you have. And it's like your projects and how you share that with the world. So can you talk about like a little project that you got going on with the bike to board?
Yeah. So I mean, it's kind of just like an ongoing project and kind of an ongoing, just like, you know, it's like I'm doing this based on, my ethics and morals. And then also the fulfillment I find from it. And I think that's why I can continue to do it, is like, sometimes because I've been doing this for a while now, it's like, this is actually my going into my fifth season where I haven't used a car or anything. I've just been biking 100% for pretty much all of my riding for this is the fifth season now. I think
that's impressive.
I'm starting like some points I maybe lose a little bit of that light and the like the awe of it actually, because it just kind of starts to become what I'm doing where, you know, like, and then the light comes through at different points, you know, but, like, especially when I first started doing it, it was like, you know, it's just like climbing the splitboarding a mountain, you know, it's like, wow, I just climbed that whole thing. Like when you add in just climbing actually like every single foot of it, it's like at points your heart is just bursting with like joy and fulfillment for the journey you've been on. So, I mean, yeah, I guess one project is just like continuing to stay committed to, this cause. So yeah, going into my fifth year, just 100% human powered access into the mountains. And then I have a couple, mainly one video project, I'm working on editing right now, which has just been it's been a long, slow process because I've just got like, I'm editing and filming this thing pretty much 100% on my own, combining that with then biking and skiing to the mountains, which takes a lot of time. And then, you know, working all summer, I just like have limited time for this. So I'm editing a video from one season ago, just because I haven't gotten around to it yet. But this is a video documenting the trip I did from the Sierra Nevada to Mount Baker, where I skied bunch of different peaks in the Sierra Nevada, and then I skied all of the volcanoes in the Cascades via my bike. And then my best friend Alex, who had passed away tragically in a whitewater kayaking accident, he joined me for all of Washington. He was a super skilled videographer and filmmaker, and so he helped me document the whole Washington portion. And so that's one project I'm working on, just getting edited up. And I'm really excited to be able to eventually, you know, show that film and share that with the world. And then going forward, I'm going to just be, for most of the winter, probably mostly local, working on just continuing the bike to board vision of accessing the mountains you know, on my bike without using fossil fuels. And then come spring, I'd like to take off on like a 3-month trip somewhere, go on another big journey. Couple ideas are floating around, but I kind of, I really like to wait and like watch the weather and see how the season develops before I commit to any ideas, because, you know, I like to go where the conditions are good and I'll have like a higher chance of getting to ride like inspiring lines. So I kind of just want to see how the snowpack sets up across the West. But I'm either thinking maybe take off from my house here in Bend and do a big loop to the Rockies and try to hit like 4 or 5 different states or something, and like just go tap in there a bunch, because I really haven't done much splitboarding out in the Rockies. I've done like a little bit in New Mexico, funnily enough. But so yeah, I'm thinking that might be my trip for this spring. Or like I was saying to you guys earlier, potentially going up and linking up with Wiggles and some other folks in Canada and trying to do a trip in the Canadian Rockies. So I'm just going to kind of wait and feel it all out. But right now, yeah, I'm going to take off on like a 3-month trip all on the bike, check out some new ranges and just go somewhere new is what I'd like to do.
Love it, dude. Love it. And I look forward to whatever you put out on the gram and the project coming up. I know it's hard to wear so many hats and balance so many things
out.
I remember that when Alex and you were on Rainier.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I was supposed to join you on that trip, and I'm so bummed. I'd love to just join you on one of these legs and just get my butt on a saddle and just paddle around.
Yeah.
And see if I can
Sure. And just meet, meet in the skin track.
So let me ask you this. When you come out here next month, are you going to, bike in, or?
I don't think so for that trip, because it
is too far.
It's too far for if I were, if I go on the spring trip, I would like to pop into Salt Lake, say what's up to all the Cardiff guys and make that like a little stop in the journey. But as far as going for this, like, you know, impromptu, like 4 or 5 day trip, unless I made that into a much bigger trip, it'd be a lot to just cruise out there. So I don't know. I'm going to figure that all out. I mean, I think part of one thing I need to give myself grace is not realizing like I don't need to always be perfect. And, you know, certain things I can make sacrifices for, and I don't need to beat myself down about it, you know, because I feel like I really try to stick like really strongly to my beliefs. And sometimes it can be like a tough inner conversation of like, what do I want to do? And, you know, I think sticking to this commitment makes my message more powerful too.
Absolutely.
You know, so, I don't know. I'm going to figure that one out. I might actually take a train out there. I'm looking at, there's a train from here to Salt Lake City. So might do that.
Well, and it's all about balance, right? You can't beat yourself up over little things that you need to travel in different ways. And good for you, man. Yeah. You're an inspiration. And I just wanted to let you know I think you inspire a lot of people with your adventures, and it's always great to watch, and everything you do is it's creating a change, and it's action.
Yeah.
Maybe for other people to create changes or kind of think about things in a different way. So kudos to that, man. I really appreciate everything you do.
Thanks, man.
So guys, I have this analytical brain that's just always working in the background, and you're talking about, sled versus riding in the backcountry on doing the bike to board thing. So I'm just kind of curious on the bike to board thing. When you're riding, obviously there's some terrain you just can't access on a bicycle, right? are you getting the benefit of like lots of fire roads and stuff like that you can ride on?
I guess I really haven't encountered too many places yet that I couldn't get to that I wanted to get to. Like I figured out a way. Like even if I end up like on a situation where I'm on a fire road and it gets too snowy or something, I usually just then like, all right, well, this is going to be quicker to skin. It's like if I start, I feel like I'm wasting time and it's not efficient. I was like, all right, I'll just skin this and I'll just kind of bust it out. Especially around here, there's a lot of forest service roads and fire roads is a lot of our access points, and it's kind of just like figuring out where the snow line is and getting to where you can get and then pushing out from there. I mean, a huge thing for me is with the biking to board is like just I have to look at the weather even more. Like I have to look at the weather beyond just when I'm snowboarding. I have to look at the timing of, okay, if I'm going to come this day before, like how am I going to get in here? Especially like right now, coming into the winter, I'd say these next like 2 months are going to be like, this is the most challenging time for me. And then it's going to get easier again. But like, this next 2 months, depth of winter, it's dark, it's cold, it's snowy. I really need to plan around it. And it's like, I could be in the mountains less if I just kind of let them do their thing on certain you know, storms and trips. But I love to ride so much that usually, like, you know, sometimes I'll try to push up somewhere and just plan to be there for a week because I know it's going to snow so hard for a week straight. That I, you know, I better just get up there, bring enough food to stay up there and camp up there and, you know, see a storm through. And then I see, okay, there's this one day where it's actually going to make sense and be safe to ride home. So I have to be very strategic about it.
Yeah. So logistically, like it throws a challenge at you, hey? Like, I mean, the whole deal, like not just the weather, but your zone and where you're going to go, where you're going to ride. Like, is it going to work, right, to ride your bike to that certain area and then get off and skin up and hit the aspect that you want to hit, right? Whatever your objective is. I mean, I've done similar things with hiking, you know, in certain areas where I'll ride my mountain bike to a certain level and then throw it in the bush and then hike from there and go from there. So, and then there's the bike, right? Like, it's not just any bike, right?
Yeah. No, it's just like a, just a nice gravel bike. I've got studded tires on there. This time of year, and you know, you get the studs on there and like ice is like cement, really. Like I haven't hit anything with those studs that it doesn't, like it feels slippery. I mean, I'd say the main sketchiest thing I'm probably doing is really there's just like one road out of here that's like sketchy for traffic, because like I said, most of the access points are just like these Forest Service roads where you're practically gonna see no one. But there's, you know, like right out of Bend here, you can go up to Mount Bachelor and the Cascade Lakes Highway. And that's probably, yeah, that's probably the sketchiest thing I'll do because it's just got high traffic on it. And talking about being strategic, that's when like, too, like I'll usually try to go early or late when the traffic is the, you know, the most limited. So like if I'm trying to go up that road and I know it's going to be busy up there, I'll just leave super early and I'll try to shoot to be, you know, at the trailhead at like 7 or something when people are just starting to come up to go to the ski area. And then same thing, like if I'm going to head down, like I'll shoot to leave after the traffic of the ski area has moved through, like after 5 o'clock, you know?
And I'm just thinking, I'm thinking locally my terrain, right? Like it's not riding a bike into a lot of where the areas where I'd want to ride or split into. You can't really ride a bike into there, and you have to split, you know, so I can see how that logistically that's always going to be a challenge for you, you know, is when it comes down to an objective and where you want to go, like having to do all that planning ahead of time, like, can I ride my bike to that area? Can I still effectively get in a tour without having to spend all day touring up to a certain zone? Right. So we were talking all, so yeah, I was just kind of curious, you know, what kind of challenge does that present you with Stratton when it comes to doing all that stuff?
Yeah, I think it just takes a little more forethought and a little more time, you know, but as far as around here, I'm always just kind of looking at like snow lines and looking at different resources online. Like you can pull up on the National Snow Analysis. You can see snow depths and stuff. So I kind of look at that kind of thing often, depending on where I'm going, to see if a road is accessible or whatnot. I've actually had some circumstances where I was able to get further on my bike than friends in a vehicle, actually. I mean, if they were on a sled, it would have been no thing. But just like as far as them cruising up the road, I've had certain circumstances, especially when you get on these Forest Service roads and it's just like patchy snowpack approaching up into an area, you can actually just like push your bike over a snow patch and then boom, you're just like cruising again. So in certain cases, it's actually like for a few miles actually turns into be a more effective form of transportation. But, you know, I feel like I always have people saying, you know, like, this would be really hard to do in my area, or like, it'd be really hard for you to do this here. And that could turn out to be the case someday, but I often have found that it's like, I don't know, it's kind of just translates kind of the same wherever I end up going. Like, I feel like when I went on that Sierra to Baker trip, I had folks that were like, yeah, this would be really hard, or like way harder to do in the Sierra. I actually found that, like, if you were based around Mammoth, it'd be actually way easier than where I am now. I mean, my really the closest riding is like 20 miles from me. So I have to go 20 miles regardless to get up to it. And there's only one road that's a plowed accessed road that's 20 miles away for me to cruise up. And that's kind of like the easiest, you know, access point. You know, and down there in the Sierra, it's like, and you could live and just like skin out your back door practically, or just go like 5 to 10 miles on like a paved road up to somewhere. It'd be way, way more mellow. So I think doing it out of Bend and the Cascades here, it has its advantages. For one, like I'm in the high desert, which is nice. Like I said, having that rain shadow effect and being where the weather is generally clear and sunnier, like approaching the mountains is nice. Like, I think being like, if I was like in Bellingham or something, or Glacier approaching the mountains up towards like Mount Baker or something, I think that'd be a lot more miserable and tough, because it would just be wet and cold, and like you would just be like drenched by the time you got up to the mountains. And I think that would like be really hard to deal with. But you know, yeah. And then here, though, I do have to like climb almost like 2,000 to 3,000 feet on my bike to get up to the most access points. And most access points are 20 to 40 miles one way. So I think it could be easier, and but it also could be harder too. So I feel like it's been a good, it was giving me a good perspective to base off of, like just doing it out of here. Like I said, it could be harder, but it could be easier too. Like, you could definitely pick a spot and be in a location where it was way easier than it is here. You know,
I'm almost exhausted just listening to it.
I'm like 20 mile approach just to go snowboarding. Yeah. To go splitboarding, you know, not snowboarding, but 20 mile approach is amazing.
Yeah, like I wonder, like in the Satch, it'd be interesting to see. I think the main thing there would be super freaking busy and sketchy on those roads. But overall, I think you'd be like, if I were based there or something, I think I could, it'd be a lot closer, and quicker to get up in that sense, you know?
Yeah, I think your vertical gain would be much more like steeper grades, right? To get up into where we're talking. But yeah, like your longer approach over 20 miles is a little bit different, but yeah, man, it's like Darren said, it almost makes me, I need a cup of coffee. I have to listen to 20 miles approach.
Yeah.
That's funny though, because Maxwell, because I'm listening and I'm thinking, fucking dude, you're pretty close to from your door to the trailhead, and man, that would be an easy bike for you. No,
I know. I should just go. Do you have a recommendation on a bike, Strat?
And like, yeah, just get a little roadie bike. Yeah. And start.
A little rigid roadie bike and just go for it.
Yeah.
Nice.
No, I don't know.
Maybe next year. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
It's a good goal to have.
Yeah. If you're going to do it, go in the spring. I mean, that's like, you go on a nice day in the spring or a nice little spring trip, and actually like, if you wanted to try it, like it'd actually be pretty enjoyable then, you know?
Absolutely. I'd have to get a sidecar for my bike though to bring Maverick.
Your dog.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You'd have to have a sidecar. So we'll have to build out like a prototype or something, a special bike that had a sidecar on it.
Yeah. That'd be good though. Get that little companion.
I'm sure he'd love it.
You got to get him the goggles.
Oh, absolutely.
Sweet, sweet. So, so you're working on that documentary. You're going to get that coming out soon. And that's obviously something you're working on going forward. I mean, you're doing all the editing in the background and doing that. Are you continuing to record missions and so that you can add to that? Or
yeah, I mean, I'd say like my kind of goal with that filmmaking lately is to focus on like actually when I'm documenting with like my nicer camera equipment and whatnot, and like trying to collect more footage. I've just ended up doing that on like more of like a specific trip I had on. Because for a while I was just like trading all this content from like every single adventure, and it just turned out like I realized I was just like swamping myself in video, and like it just didn't have time to like actually edit it all or like create something from it. So I kind of like, my focus is, you know, I'm going to head out on this 3-month trip this spring. That'll be a cool story that I can, you know, there's specifically a story that's going to be, you know, unfolding there. And I'll be able to document that trip specifically and just focus my efforts for that trip, collect all that content, and then make a video based on that. And then in between, when I'm just doing all these just like, you know, daily adventures and trips, it's kind of just more like collecting some videos and stuff for social media to just like share the stoke and whatnot, and put little things out that don't take very much time to create, you know? But I purely just don't have enough time to edit it all. And as much as I like editing and stuff, it's also super exhausting. And like, if it came down to me having to stay inside on a nice day to when I could go ride powder, like that's just kind of like, you know, it's not what I want to be doing. Like after my friend Alex passed away, it just really showed me like, I want to live every day and take full advantage of it. I could die tomorrow. Like I want to do exactly what I wanted to be doing today. You know?
Yeah, I hear you, dude. Yeah. It sounds like that 3-month trip could be a little dock on its own for sure. And, man, I'm envisioning maybe a little piece in Banff Mountain Film Festival that you should aim at.
Yeah.
I mean, like that'd be a great little vignette in one of those.
For sure. I mean, that's what I'd like to do with this next film I put out, is like send it into some film festivals. And I mean, that's part of like, it's like all of that takes so much energy, just like working on like properly getting like a proper rollout and like getting it in into all these different, you know, publishers and outlets and stuff, like that all just takes time. And but it's worth it, especially when you put a lot of time into a project. You gotta like do it justice when you release it.
Yeah, 100%. Well, man, there's a lot going on with this dude. Hey, Maxwell,
absolutely.
Like,
that's why we have him on.
There's a lot to explore. You know, I think we can wrap up this episode somewhere around here. I think we might need to revisit some stuff, man, going forward, and see how your season's shaping up and how those docs are coming along, man. I look forward to that.
Yeah.
Cool. So before we let you go, man, always love to ask a quick question about what's in your backpack when you go out touring. You know, obviously you got some video gear and whatnot, but is there anything specifically, Stratton, that you carry in your pack that might be a little bit different than what other people carry? And what do you like to eat while you're out there, man? Because it sounds like you fucking need a lot of fuel for your missions, man.
Yeah, I would definitely. That's true. Let's see. I mean, so as far as food goes, it's always kind of switching up. I usually get into like a little routine for like a season or two of like what I'm packing away. Like, for a while I was like really dedicated to just like getting all these bulk items and just getting like trail mix and stuff and lots of dried fruit whatnot. But then I kind of like, actually I got a couple kidney stones and found out that like I had to limit how many nuts I was having and whatnot, so I cut back on that. And I've kind of gotten into this new program where like I usually carry like a bag of chips, actually, but I'll just like get the bag of chips prior, crunch them all up, throw it in a Ziploc, because it doesn't matter to me that they're like completely crunched up. I just try to pack it down. I'll usually have that because like you have a lot of calories, it's salty, and they're really satisfying. So I usually will eat that and like, you know, 5 bars or something for the day, and some dried fruit of some sort, usually like dried mango or something. Maybe like a one little jerky bar, like a handful of trail mix. Because like I said, I used to have tons of that, found out that I was having too many nuts. And then also like I would just always like not be inspired. So I try to get some food that I'm like more inspired to eat, that's like satisfying and I want to eat it. And
Yeah, been a lot of water. I drink a lot of water, more so than some of my ski partners. So I usually carry just like a 3-liter bladder with me. Because I usually, like, most of the days, like, I ski terrain too, I like a full day. Like, I'll be out like 8 to 12 hours. So I need a lot of water for like a full day. I'm a big proponent of having a little hydration bladder with a little, little tube. Just because I find that I feel the best when I'm like constantly hydrated. I don't have to stop either to like take breaks to drink water. Because otherwise, like, I don't know, I'll go out with people that don't have that, and you'll have to stop and make a break specifically to drink water. And for one, I couldn't like stop enough to like stay properly hydrated. So I backed that. As far as what else is in my bag, I first aid kit, almost like a whole set of spare parts for my bindings, of anything that like usually could break. I always carry plenty of extra insulative layers. Probably not enough most days to like actually stay out at night, but hopefully enough to stay out the night if I had to. I always just try to come prepared for the worst. So I'd rather not like go light on a extra layer that could like save your life, you know. Especially you think, oh, it's not that, like, I'm not going to need this layer today. But as soon as someone gets hurt and you're staying there for even an hour or two, like, you're going to get cold really quickly. And so I think it's really important to have extra layers, more than what you would ever wear that day. And, like, maybe reasonably you could try to stay the night with. And I usually carry just, like, a little emergency blanket thing in there. Although, honestly, like, those things... they're not like that great, but I think it could help. I pretty much always carry my headlamp with me. Like I said, I tend to go on like pretty long full days, so I pretty much always have my headlamp. Extra battery pack too for like phone, whatnot. Carry a satellite phone too for emergencies. Obviously shovel, probe, all that gear. A little extra food too, little extra emergency calories or whatever to just like keep the motivation high.
Extra bag of chips.
Extra bag of chips.
Bucket of chicken.
Yeah. A little rotisserie. I think that's mostly what I carry. I'm trying to think if there's anything else.
That's a lot, man. That's you got a lot going on. It's interesting how you talked about having enough layers if you had to spend the night, mm-hmm. potentially, and then you talked about like the emergency bivy, like one of those, like just like a Mylar blanket type of thing, like one of those soul bivies or something like that. And it's funny because you watch and you hear of all these theories on how to use those things. And I often wonder, like, what would it be like to actually have to spend time in one of those,
Probably suck.
probably would suck, but you know what? It'd probably be better than not having it too, though, at the same time.
Getting hyperthermia. One thing also, I always carry like quite a few Volé straps. For one, like my bike setup, I have to have all these Volé straps, but the amount of Volé strap that I need to be able to rig my bike or my snowboard onto my bike is also like, I think, a pretty fair amount to have for emergencies and equipment failures, So like I usually have like 6 Volé straps or whatnot. Skins will fail, and then you're like Volé strapping your skins. If you had to splint someone's limb or something, I think it's good to have a lot of Volé straps for that kind of issue, or like a pole that breaks, whatever. So I think that's another good little like kind of emergency backup thing to have, is like a good amount of Volé straps. And honestly, like I said, to have 6, it's like if my skins fail, I need like 2 Volé straps for each skin. and then whatever else failed. Like, I like to have enough for whatever potentially could happen.
10-4, yeah. Yeah. I think we've all had those little emergencies where we've had to jerry-rig something up in order to get out of the bush, right, and make it out. So, and they're always a learning experience every time that happens, right? Well, next time I'll have this in my bag and this, and just throw that extra stuff mm-hmm. in. Cool, man. Sweet. Well, dude, you know, one of these days, you know, I say this every episode, man, got to get out to where you are and experience some of that riding, man. Yeah. I mean, I've never ridden volcanoes before and hit that kind of stuff, so... I'd love to see that kind of action. Yeah. Got to get out there.
You love it come spring. When we take, especially.
Yeah, no doubt. Because it'll be warmer.
Warm, nice corn, like just good weather. And like, that. I mean, the spring long here days. Is such nice living. It really is. Like you just like hang out in the rainforest. Yeah, no, like there's good snow. It's just really good living.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Looking forward to it. Cool, man. Well, thanks for joining us, Stratton. Super stoked to have you on, man, and meet you and see those docs coming forward, man. I just can't wait till those come out. So let's. This is the part of the show where we give you a chance to shout out and give some love to all your all those people that are backing you, all those companies, your sponsors, and stuff like that. And then a shout out to your socials so everybody knows where to follow along.
Shout out to my new board sponsor Cardiff. Stoked to be riding for them and on the team there. Just like a good group of like-minded individuals on that team, and I think it's just really going to mesh well and going to be able to collaborate on projects and just ride with some really talented folks that are all like, you know, on similar paths and visions. So excited about Cardiff. And then Patagonia Snow for outerwear and whatnot. And then Karakoram is who I ride for bindings. And then also supported by Astral Footwear, Mountain Flow Eco Wax, who makes plant-based non-petroleum wax, so we're not, you know, putting petroleum right into the snowpack and then into our rivers and creeks and watersheds. So really stoked about them. And then also locally Orgrown and Avid Cider. And those are my sponsors. And then find me at Cascade Connections on Instagram. And also Cascade Connections on YouTube, where I have the last like major film I made, Shift, is on there. And that kind of explains my whole shift to biking to board. So that'll go into it more too, if you want to like kind of learn more about my ethos and why I'm doing this. It's explained in that film. And then it goes into some of the adventures I went on, like when I was first starting this journey. My best friend Alex is in that film, and some of my other good riding buddies. And I don't post on there super regularly, but I do have like a decent amount of videos on there. And that's also eventually some of the other docs will be published on there as well.
Love it, Stratton. Love it, dude. Thank you so much for sharing all that. Thank you so much for sharing your story, man. You're an inspiration. I can't say it enough. And stoked to hang with you next month.
Heck yeah, me too, Maxwell.
Get on the skin track and share some lines with you.
That'll be great.
Very excited about that.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, guys. My pleasure to join you guys here. Good conversation.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, man.
Well, hope you guys have a good winter in that lot of soft lines ahead for everyone.
Thanks, man.
Send that snow that's falling in your neck of the woods this way, buddy. Yep. We'll take another one.
It'll push towards you, I'm sure.
All right, sweet Stratton. Thanks, man. Peace, brother.
All right, cheers, guys.
Thanks, buddy. Cheers.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening, and a special thanks to Stratton for taking the time to talk with us. As always, you can learn more about Stratton in the show notes. If you're loving the podcast, then be sure to hit the subscribe button, drop us a review, and share it with your crew. Also, visit our website at darkstarts.ca and follow us on Instagram at darkstarts.podcast. Maxwell and I want to give a special thanks to the Dark Starts team for helping to make all of this happen. Stay safe out there, everybody. Peace.